Welcome to the Fretboard Journal Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde. As always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. I'm going to put out two episodes this week. The one you are listening to right now, and then another one all about the Fretboard Summit. Our Fretboard Summit's taking place in Chicago in just over a month, August 24th to 26th. You can still register at fretboardsummit.org. I want everyone who enjoys this podcast, who is tuning in, to feel invited. Please, please come if you can. If you just want to go guitar shopping, we've got a 50-plus exhibitor luthery show going on where you can just go try out amazing guitars from some of the greatest guitar makers alive today. We also have the Ne Plus Ultra programming that I've been working on. Great concerts featuring everybody from Jeff Parker and Tommy Emmanuel to Wayne Henderson's going to be there. Bill Frisell's going to be there. We've got workshops galore. We've got all sorts of music history stuff. We've got hands-on exhibits. A room just for fans of the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast filled with vintage amps you can try out and so much more. The lineup of people attending is truly staggering and includes, I don't know, 40 plus people who have been on this very podcast. So if you've ever wanted to just take a selfish vacation and immerse yourself in guitar culture and hang out with me and some Fretboard Journal contributors and some of the many people you've heard about on this show, come one, come all. It's all taking place at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago, and I would love to see you there. And if anyone has any questions about this event, because I know it's different from going to a NAMM show or going to a typical guitar show, hit me up, podcast@fretboardjournal.com. That is the best way to send me any questions, but just trust me when I say you're going to want to be there. This lineup will never be duplicated. So today's podcast, Jonathan Stout is not coming to this year's Fretboard Summit, but we're going to get him to maybe the 2024 one because it's my favorite kind of interview. I get to meet for the first time somebody doing something truly interesting. I get to share their story with you. I think that's why so many of you listen to this podcast and love it. Jonathan works in a subgenre of a subgenre. He is a guitarist and band leader making music for swing dance competitions. I didn't really know this world existed, but he came through Washington State as part of Matt Munisteri's great swing guitar program at Centrum up in Port Townsend, Washington. He blew me away not only with his guitar knowledge, but also just his love for jazz history. He's an incredible player. If you check out our show notes, I'm going to include a link to his solo jazz guitar album that's on Bandcamp. It's truly remarkable. And if you want bonus points, you can go to fretboardjournal.com or our YouTube channel right now and see Jonathan playing at the Fretboard Journal offices. We got him playing an original tune on his vintage L5. It's a truly cool interview. I can't wait for you all to digest this one. Now, let me just say we have some sponsors for this show. Of course, Peghead Nation. Matt Munisteri is an instructor at Peghead Nation. You can get your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription with the promo code Fretboard when you check out. Let them know the Fretboard Journal sent you. I love these guys. I know you will too. One of the great music instruction platforms around. You can still get 10% off of your iZotope by using the discount code FRET10. Stringjoy Strings is still offering you all 10% off your first order at stringjoy.com with the promo code FRETBOARD. And then last but not least, Seattle's own Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar is sponsoring the podcast once again. So Jonathan Stout plays a couple of vintage Gibson L5s. I wanted to see what Mike and Mike's had in the archtop category, and they have so much right now. They've got a 1939 Super 400. They've got a 1953 Epiphone Zephyr Emperor Regent. They've got a 36 Recording King M5, on and on. A 50s Bacon Belmont Gretsch-made archtop with D'Armon Dynasonics on it. I've never even seen one of those, and so many other great things. So go to mmguitarbar.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. Also follow them on Instagram, of course. And if you're ever in Seattle, go visit their showroom. It's amazing. It's over in our Fremont neighborhood. Those are my big updates. Again, thank you all for listening. If you love this show and really want to be my best friend, share it on Facebook, share it on Instagram. It goes a long way towards helping this podcast grow. I think you are all going to love this interview with Jonathan Stout. I think you're all going to want him back on the show. We can make that happen. And like I said, please sign up for our Fretboard Summit taking place August 24th to 26th in Chicago. If you want to meet some of the many characters you've met on the Fretboard Journal podcast, it is your best place. Here is my conversation with Jonathan Stout. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
My sincere pleasure, man. Thanks so much for having me.
So we hung out, what, a week ago, 2 weeks ago? I can't even remember. And you did a couple songs here for our video cameras, which we'll be sharing. But from the minute you started talking and you brought out your L5, I was like, oh my gosh, we got to get you on the podcast because you have guitar story after guitar story. You've led a fascinating life, and here we are.
Oh, I'm delighted someone finds my nerdery interesting, even in the slightest.
Well, and you have nerdery going on from several different angles, because I think of most, you're probably better known in the dance community, right? Than yeah. in the guitar community. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for the last 21 years, it's been sort of my business to make swing dance music for swing dancers. And I didn't realize at the time that I wasn't merely like trying to recreate a lost art, but actually that it was this entirely postmodern thing of like, oh, modern swing dancers are actually pretty good. And there's a lot of them and they like to dance with each other, not just like show off. So like the dance tempos that they like are an entirely modern creation. And like their expectations have been set by people DJing original era tracks for the last 40, almost 50 years now. And so like if you listen to an old radio broadcast of a swing band, you know, from the Savoy Ballroom, even the birthplace of Lindy Hop, like the main swing dance, the tempo selection is actually surprisingly unfriendly to like a modern dancer because we're all pretty good and we can like change partners every song. So there's sort of like, you want a nice set of medium tempo tunes and then some upper tempo tunes. And there's sort of a range. And it's almost like a, like, I think there's a lot of parallels to house music, believe it or not.
Sure.
Where like basically DJs started hyper curating this one particular genre and then people start making music to fit that genre. And so I'm basically thought I was recreating swing music that was being underserved. And it turns out like, oh, actually this is a whole nother thing. And, you know, and these little constraints, like everything was based on a 78 RPM record back then. So like all of our dance attention spans are like 3.5 minutes because of that. And you can complain that that's like inhuman in one level, but it's also just what it is, you know?
So what came first, the dance side or the music guitar side?
Well, I started playing guitar like in elementary school. Okay. And like I'm a 90s kid. I'm a elder millennial with Gen X pretension. I started playing, I think in 91 or 92. And that was like right before grunge hit. So it was like classic rock stuff, Hendrix and then Metallica. And I'll always credit like Kirk Hammett for making me want to actually like play proficiently. Mm-hmm. 'Cause like I have friends that started like a year or two after me. And for some of them, like once grunge hit, they were like cool with a couple power chords and calling it a day. And I wanted to like solo, but yeah, I was like all that grunge stuff, Nirvana. I mean, for a while, my first band was like practically a Nirvana cover band. And then we went goth industrial for a time. And there was a lot of U2 and The Cure and stuff mixed in there. And, but the thing, which is why I recognized the Ministry t-shirt on the sound guy at the Century Ballroom a week and a half ago. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah, you know, Psalm 69. I remember getting that from Columbia House back in the day. Not a lot of swing dance band leaders are going to reference Ministry. So hopefully that'll be yeah. an Easter egg for some folks. But I started swing dancing in high school. I went to this magnet school where, you know, the point is to like move people all around Los Angeles and sort of like, you know, fight the fact that the city was not particularly integrated. And so they created these schemes to bus kids around so that they could actually integrate things. And that was a really lucky thing for me. But our Spanish teacher, because we had this cadre of kids in our high school that were all nerdy and kind of removed from their neighborhood in a way, because they were being bussed away. And so we had she had to kind of create a sense of community, and the school is really good about that. So she started doing tango lessons the year before, because that was like a thing adjunctly related to, say, Spanish. And then she got bored of it. So the next year she's like, oh, let's take swing lessons. And this was like really on the cusp of that whole revival thing happening. And so we just started taking swing dance lessons. I'm sitting there in like, you know, Doc Martens and like a black band t-shirt and like taking swing dance lessons. And for whatever reason, it just like really struck me. Like, so it was my playing with the mashed potatoes moment, like in Close Encounters, like this means something. Like, I don't know. And then music also just really struck me, and it got me into jazz in a very general sense. And that's, so yeah, I go by Kind of Blue, you go by Blue Train, you go by Giant Steps. And I fell in love with like people like Grant Green and Kenny Burrell, kind of later Blue Note, hard bop guitar players. And throughout the rest of high school, I just like, oh, that's what I'll be a jazz guitar player. And I ended up going to USC, the University of Southern California, which has a very good jazz school. And the thing about it is I was just going to go get a history degree and then go to law school, which happened. All of that happened. I'm also a lawyer, which is sort of funny. Although I'm a musician at this point, I was just going to get a history degree, and I go to the orientation. They're like, oh yeah, we have a studio jazz guitar program. And I remember seeing Carl Verheyen's columns in Guitar for the Practicing Musician about like recreating the Hendrix Star Spangled Banner for Dusk Till Dawn. And like, cause it's cheaper to like re-record it than to pay the the licensing to the Woodstock movie. And I thought that was like the coolest job ever. And then I was into jazz guitar. I thought, oh, that'll be a real cool, fun thing to do as a double major. And as it turns out, like, it was not a good fit for me. And it just kind of made me not like playing guitar after a certain point. And that was the same time where I met a bunch of people swing dancing for real. Like, we were taking lessons at our high school and like taking dance lessons once a week, but we weren't really able to go anywhere where real people were doing it. And so like right after I start college, I start meeting the local people. And like one of those people that I met that, you know, first part of college is this guy, Nick Williams, who's like one of the, you know, best Lindy Hoppers in the world. And this one world Lindy Hop champion. And, you know, like that was my college buddy. And so I got really into dancing. And as my interest in guitar sort of waxed, waned, doesn't matter. As it sort of started going down, like the interest in dancing sort of went up. And so instead of like looking online at guitar things, it was looking for dance things. And by the end of my freshman year of college, I didn't really want to play guitar anymore. And I had actually gotten a D in a 2-unit guitar class because I had failed to memorize a Charlie Christian solo. Which is like the most ridiculous thing, but it was a thing that I couldn't memorize solos very well. I didn't know how to transcribe things. And even when the transcription was presented, it's very hard to internalize it. But so I was just kind of done playing guitar, but I was dancing 7 nights a week. And like, I'd met my wife, or my now wife, and we were just dancing all the time. And I basically came home from college that summer. I mean, I'm from Los Angeles, so it wasn't very far, but I came home and we're just kind of done. And then about a week or two into summer vacation, I go over to my best friend's house, who we'd grown up playing guitar together, and we rent the Woody Allen movie Sweet and Lowdown, which features the great Howard Alden playing the soundtrack as a fictional 1930s Django style guitar player, played on the movie by Sean Penn. And it immediately just like struck me as like, oh, why aren't I doing that? And so I like picked up a guitar right after the movie, and I, you know, from what little I knew of that stuff, I just started trying to fake Django. And it was so much more true than anything I tried to do before. I'd always like wanted to play like somebody like Grant Green or Kenny Burrell, and I could get the funky like double stop kind of licks that they would do, but the bebop underpinnings, I could just never really bop properly. And when I started trying to play Django-y, it was like, oh no, that's the thing. And I was really lucky. My uncle's a trombone player and, you know, professional musician, and like, you know, worked with all sorts of people. He was doing charts for American Idol before he retired. So like, you know, pro musician, arranger. And many years throughout growing up, he'd got me a lesson with some pro guitar player for my birthday that was like doing whatever I was into. So when I was into like U2 and The Cure, he got me a lesson with a guy who had like effects rig and like kind of what you could do with it. And when I started trying to learn jazz, he got me a lesson with a bebop guy that I just didn't get anything out of because I just didn't get it. But this one, he set me up with a guy he knew from playing at Disneyland, which has always sort of had a lot of traditional jazz on site. And it was this guy, John Reynolds. And John Reynolds is sort of like probably one of the greatest unknown pre-war guitar players, where it's like the Eddie Lang, the Django. He plays just profoundly good tenor banjo. And he grew up with people like Howard Alden in that sort of generation of like 60s kids that, rather than like going the hippie route, kind of went the old jazz route, like the Art Crumb sort of scene. And I show up at his house and he's like this mad scientist, kind of mad cartoonist dude. And he's just like, hold on a second, man, I'm watching this movie. And it turns out he's watching this Marx Brothers movie that has one of the most famous Lindy Hop scenes in it of all time. It's called The Day at the Races. And he's watching the scene with the Lindy Hop to like, it was like, how does All God's Children Got Rhythm go? I was trying to remember the chords. And it was just this like monkey meet the monolith moment of like, oh, the chocolate and the peanut butter together. Oh my gosh, dancing and guitar. And then he gave me this guitar lesson and, you know, he's a mad scientist. So it wasn't like very like, okay, here's the authorized curriculum, but he just sort of jammed with me and showed me a couple little tricks. And it was like the most inspiring thing in the world to like tap into that. And that's sort of like what set me on the path. And then I just spent like the next couple of years of college being a bedroom rocker, where I was just learning as much stuff as I could in my bedroom. And the internet had really kicked in by then with a lot of like Django resources, things like Django books, and their forums were up. And there was this website called classicjazzguitar.com, and it had real audio samples. That's how old of a website it was. And it had audio samples of all of these swing era guitar feature things. So it'd be like a little clip. And I can't underestimate the importance of that website, because that's where I first heard the name Alan Roos. And I first heard all of his solos being quoted on that. And people, other famous or less famous swing guitar players, people like Irving Ashby or Carmen Mastren or Carl Kress, Dick McDonough, George Van Epps, like all of the sort of classic guitar folks from the swing era. And basically that, hearing those and having Napster and LimeWire and all of those streaming things, like I just streamed all, like downloaded all of those. Cause trying to find them on various CDs would have been like hundreds of dollars to like, okay, buy a CD for one song. But I was able to like cherry pick all the things that I wanted. And then there was also this Charlie Christian website that has fallen off the internet by this guy, Gary Hansen, who I've become Facebook friends with. And I saved the website. And at some point he authorized me to put it back up.
Oh, cool.
But it was the best thing, cause he had a bunch of transcriptions and notes and tab. And this is the website that I failed to learn that solo from.
Yeah.
But it did this thing where like it would show you a shape, like a geometric shape on the fingerboard. And then it would show you the way Charlie would sort of take that chord shape and just hang a couple extra notes on it, like a little scale, and it'd be overlaid over the chord shape. And then you show you like three or four times that he played a lick in from that position. And you go, oh, there's like a whole little basic system here. And like, you know, 25 years later, that's exactly how I approach single note playing. That's how I visualize the chord melody playing, because Roos is doing almost the same thing. This guy, Alan Roos, who I really love. But yeah, it was like all of this kind of journey of like swing dancing led me to jazz. Jazz kind of bottomed out, but then swing dancing somehow pulled me back into playing jazz guitar and in this style. And then I just sort of like had to research on my own. And that was sort of a crazy thing, but it wasn't until I started playing with people that like really the rubber met the road. And the really lucky thing is a guy that I knew from swing dancing, this drummer named Josh Collazo, you know, in 1998, 99, he was like winning top contests. But like later he'd go on to be the drummer for Edward Sharpe. And He's also been our drummer in all of our bands for the last 21 years, but he started a band first, and that guy, John Reynolds, couldn't make the first gig. And he called me to sub, or not John Reynolds, but Josh called me to sub for him. And in 6 months, I kind of subbed on and off, and it was the most amazing thing. Cause like in 6 months I got better faster than I had in 2 years by myself. And then basically like watching that band kind of worked, my singer, and business partner, Hillary Alexander, she's also a swing dancer, and she makes her main living by basically throwing a swing dance convention every year. And it's like one of the biggest swing dance events in the world. And like, you know, 1500 people from all over the world fly in, every year to come to this thing. And at this point we headline it, and it's fun. But she's like, hey, like Josh threw together a band that worked. Do you want to, why don't we try and do a band? And I had previously kind of jammed with some musicians, some like dancers who also played music on and off. But, you know, that demarcation of like being able to kind of like play a solo or goof around on a guitar and then how to play changes is a real dividing line. And I struggle still to like explain to people and get people over that hump. But the dancers I was playing with, like, maybe didn't necessarily know that, or like I could do all the soloing, but you know, in tennis, they say play up, right? You would play with people better than you, cause that's how you get better. And in playing in Josh's band, he basically just, it was him and then a bunch of like pros that he knew from other bands. And then me occasionally, and I just got so much better. I said, oh, well, let's just hire pros. So we hired Josh, and then, and I'll go on record saying Josh Collazo is like literally the world's greatest living swing drummer. And you're like, oh, the guy from Edward Sharpe and the Magnetics Heroes? Yeah. Yeah. Like the guy who knows the most about Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich and Chick Webb and Sonny Greer and Joe Jones and all of these people, like, is the guy that happens to also play in Edward Sharpe. And, but it was, so he's just been the best, and he's been the best for a million years now. But it was so inspiring to like see these other musicians and hear like real pros. And basically, like, after 6 months of playing with him and Josh's band, we started our own band. And then it's just been 21 years of doing that. And at some point I can stop talking so you can ask a question.
I have so many questions.
Yeah, so please.
Before Josh, when you were doing these competitions, and were you competitive? Did you ever win?
Yeah. I mean, the year that we started the band, and we had our first gig at our second technically gig was at our singer's event, Camp Hollywood. That year, my wife and I competed, and we were on the first place team, and we got second in the AM division of one of the particular sub dances. One thing I wanted to mention is in LA, there was this cadre of 80-year-old, 90-year-old people that were still dancing from the original era. And they weren't just like random people that happened to dance. Like, that's cute. These were the people that were in all of the movies. And it's important to address that there's kind of some like creepy racist stuff about swing dancing in movies, because it's this black dance that originates in Harlem at the Savoy Ballroom. And people like Frankie Manning and the rest of the Whiteys, Lindy Hoppers, Al Mins, there's all these black dancers that create this dance. And in old movies, if you were going to have black dancers featured in a scene, it needed to be in a scene that didn't have any plot, so that you could cut it out in places that were not interested in that because they were racist. And so if you wanted to have dancers in the background of a scene where the plot was happening, where like the main actors were talking to each other in a thing that made a difference, you'd have to show white dancers. And so in all of these movies, you have this sort of dichotomy where they would have these New York dancers that were black that would come out and do these feature numbers. And then like the high school kids in the background of every scene would be these LA dancers. And there was this one particular white dancer who learned Lindy Hop in Harlem and kind of brought it out here and then taught almost everybody out here. And then we had some of our own little regional dances. And so those people were who we found in the 90s and started like learning from, not like, you know, they weren't like, just like with John Reynolds, like there wasn't a curriculum, but like they would like show us like, no, you're doing it wrong. And you'd have to kind of figure it out. But we had this kind of living connection to these people that had been in all of these movies. And like this one guy, Hal Take here, you know, he was the kind of guy that like he won all these dance contests and like he'd run into Artie Shaw like 50 years later and Artie Shaw would be like, oh, Hal Take here, you know. So we were really lucky to have that like kind of living connection to all of that stuff. And then on the kind of Harlem dance side of it, there were people like Frankie Manning, who was this basically the main choreographer for the best group back then that was in A Day at the Races and choreographed all these numbers. And he basically spent the last like 20, 30 years of his life traveling the world as a living legend, teaching dance literally all over the world. So like we were really lucky. We had this like personal connection to these people that did this thing. And so like when we competed, a lot of it was, you know, not just like, oh, dance is fun, but like we really had this like living thing that this is part of a tradition. It's part of a history and that these things all kind of go together. And you know, it comes from somewhere and we're trying to like preserve the legacies of these people, you know?
Yeah. Were the 80 and 90 year old legends like the judges or were they just kind of there?
They would be at those events as sort of like the greatest living resource. And they're just hanging out and you get to watch them dance and stuff. And, you know, like we were lucky that like the cake topper at our wedding came from John and Ann Mills, this famous Balboa couple. And, you know, like all these people we were so lucky to have this interaction with, but yeah, they would be hanging out, but they weren't like schooled dancers. They were street dancers. This is all a street dance. So like, you know, there isn't this like, oh, well, that's a 10-point deduction because of such and such, you know, like it was all street. So they didn't judge that much, but like, you know, we'd get to hang out with them at, say, not maybe big events, but just like their weekly dance that they would go to.
Yeah. Do you win money if you win this?
Yeah, you do. It's not, we have a joke, like ain't nobody getting rich in Lindy Hop because it's all this like, you know, like, everybody's really doing it for the love of it. So it's not like, there's actually a form of Lindy Hop that evolved and kind of just kept changing with music. And so it's called West Coast Swing.
Okay.
And it's like people started dancing to like soul music and then disco and then maybe in modern like dance pop. And that's like real high dollar, high stakes stuff. And the joke is like, we're jitterbugs and they're glitterbugs because it's very like formal ballroom dance style aesthetics. But like, that's a different thing. So this was, you know, like you could win a couple bucks, but it definitely wasn't like, you know, a house payment.
Yeah. Yeah. And before you mentioned Josh's band sort of being this path that you ended up kind of going down and hiring him before that, when you were participating in these, was there live music accompaniment or was it mostly just playing records?
At your like average weekly dance, a lot of it was DJed. And then oddly, even when there was live music, so much of the live music was actually poorly serving the event. And I remember that some of the bands we would see back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was like you would wait for the band to stop and the DJ could come on so you could dance. Because I mean, it was a good example. Like, I remember Hillary, my singer, was running a weekly dance for a while. And she hired the saxophone player from one of the big bands that we liked and respected and asked him to throw together something. And he showed up and it was like the greatest level of condescension for everything. Like no effort. Like he just picked tunes that were sort of vaguely from the swing era and then like played them in like these 8-minute versions that were like the most onanistic jazz odysseys, you know. But one thing I want, this is something I think you'll find interesting. When people come from like a pop rock background, like most guitar players nowadays, when you think of a song, you probably don't think of like the song as a composition. You think of like that recording. Like if I think of Purple Haze, I don't think of like the construction of the chords to that song. I think of Jimi Hendrix playing it. And like very famous versions. And, you know, like there's a whole art to cover songs and stuff and reinterpreting. But like we think of like you go to see the band, they do the song like it's on the record. And in jazz, after the swing era, you really lose this idea of like a particular version of a song. You just think of like, oh, we're going to play Bye Bye Blackbird or whatever tune. And just because you pick a song that happens to date from the swing era doesn't mean that it's swing when you play it, because people are going to add new harmonies and they're going to play kind of bebop licks over it. And rhythmically, there's a huge thing about the rhythm is just not the same kind of post bebop. And so like, you know, like you can call the song Airmail Special, which is a, you know, Charlie Christian, Lionel Hampton kind of composition. But it doesn't mean that it's going to swing, and it doesn't mean that it's going to be swingy. And so like, it was so funny because we would wait for the bands to be done, because they would play tunes that would be swing tunes, but they would play them like it was Miles Davis, 1962 mm-hmm. or something. And you're like, yeah, that's great. You're just playing unhip bebop. Like, good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned the Woody Allen film, and that's a great one. I got to ask, like, where in the timeline does Swingers, the movie, come into this? Were you already well-versed in this scene when that hit?
No, I mean, and that came out sort of right in that big revival time. And I hadn't even got, like, I was still in high school when that happened. So that happened. The Gap ad, it was a big thing. And like Brian Setzer having a big hit with things and Royal Crown of You and all those guys. And no, I wasn't in the greater scene yet. I was just taking these dance lessons. And the person that was giving us these dance lessons, the reason I mentioned like being a millennial with these Gen X tendencies is, she had this total like alternative rock attitude about it, which was, we're not doing that cookie cutter, like cartoon shit. We're going to do the real thing where, like, you know, you're not going to just put on a clown costume in that style. And like, no, this is the real stuff, because she was in this group of people that had started to rediscover this dance, and not from like a ballroom dance studio, but like watching old movies and seeing all these Harlem dancers, all of these LA dancers, and actually like going, oh, that's that. And then she was in among the people that found like, oh, those LA dancers, they're over here. They go to this Bobby McGee's restaurant every other Sunday, and you can go dance with them. And so in that very like alternative rock way of like, we're not listening to the hair metal anymore, now we're punk rock and we're going to do this right, I had that same sort of attitude about it. So like all of that swing dance revival stuff I'd liked at that time, but she was telling us like, no, this is lame. This is good. And when I finally tapped into that scene, I was like, yes, this is lame. This is terrible. And it's like, dude, I loved Royal Crown of You, and I worked with so many of the people in that band, but it was also that thing of like, all of that kind of like cheesy swing dance revival stuff was like, oh no. And like, I still can't listen to Louis Prima. I mean, bless his heart, he rules. He's so good. And, but like that, all of that sort of corny stuff, or like later, especially later stuff. Cause like, it's really weird. Like if you're like into like, I don't know, metal, and you, whatever subgenre of metal you're into, you know, it's cute when your friends are like, you like metal, you're going to love this. And you're like, oh no, that's not the thing. Like, no. Aerosmith is not, I mean, that's good, but that's not the metal that I'm into. And you're like, but come on, it's got loud guitars. Like, no, this is a specific thing. So people would play us like 50s Count Basie. They'd be like, no, 30s and 40s Count Basie. Oh, here's some Frank Sinatra, like Fly Me to the Moon. That's 1958. Stop it. Like the crooner thing, the Great American Songbook thing. And it wasn't out of like, I mean, part of it was that just ridiculous attitude of that alternative rock energy of like, no, man, screw you, we're punk rock, you don't know, you're not punk. Part of it was that, but part of it was also like, there's this thing that happens in American popular music where the rhythm shifts from the beginning of the 20th century to the middle of the 20th century. And when like the 20th century starts, like you have the beginnings of jazz, you have like folk musics, you have old time martial music, marching music, Sousa, stuff like that. And it's all this like 1/3 music. Womp, 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 womp. Like when people make fun of the audience of a Prairie Home Companion for clapping on 1/3, like on the one hand, funny joke. On the other hand, they're actually not as wrong as you think they are. Cause like that music is actually 1/3 music. And then old jazz, like New Orleans jazz, Chicago jazz, 20s jazz, it's got this emphasis on 1/3. And swing is when it evens out and it starts being, instead of womp, womp, it goes boom, dum, 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 dum. And it's got this 1930s house music vibe. where it's all four on the floor and the rhythm guitar does that. But the thing that happens sort of in the mid 40s when bebop comes in is they drop that thump and they start to kind of anchor on the two and four, like the chick of a hi-hat. So, and it's funny, like the kind of modern concept of backbeat based music, like all of rock and roll and soul and everything that kind of comes after that, there's kind of an anchoring to that two and four that stops being about the four on the floor, and it sort of leans back in a way. And so you'll hear like a modern re-recording, even if it's like a note for note, like they literally got the old chart from an Artie Shaw chart and they re-record it with sort of modern jazz musicians. It's got less energy because the way they naturally phrase is sort of behind the beat and anchoring to that two and four instead of having that one and three. And if I hadn't been a dancer, I wouldn't have felt that.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that there's like a lot of attitudes about like playing dance music. It's like, oh no, we're going to play art music, or like, you know, why should I have to play for dancers? But I'm like, if you're in a funk band and you can't rock a party, like you're doing it wrong. Sure. Like then you're just a bad fusion band, I guess.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. You're giving us a masterclass here. And at some point you become a drummer too, right?
Well, yeah, I kind of always played drums like in like my high school band, rock band. I mean, I would just like go jump on the drums while everyone else was still eating pizza for lunch. But watching Josh, and then sort of there weren't very many subs that you could call that did the thing.
Yeah,
that would play like with an old kit and play with that old feel. And so like I just sort of had to learn to do it because every once in a while I would need to. And then especially when Edward Sharp got big for as many years as it is, it was like, oh, so you're going to be gone for 6 months. I guess if I want to work, I'm going to have to play drums instead. And again, it was really informed by like that rhythm and feeling what was missing when you got just like a really good straight ahead jazz drummer. Like there's a million amazing jazz drummers in Los Angeles. It's like, it's a big town.
Yeah.
But they show up with, I mean, you know, it's like we're guitar players. You know, you see a guy at a country gig and he shows up with like a BC Rich. You're going to be like, huh, interesting. You know, you're like, is that, I mean, I don't doubt that it can be done, but it sort of seems to me like you haven't committed to the thing. And not, you know, because the gear isn't actually that important, but it sort of just is an indicator of your intention. And so like, you know, these guys would show up with tiny bass drums and big ride cymbals, and I would be like, no, the other way around. Big bass drum, tiny cymbals. And like, if you're a really great drummer, you can make that stuff work. Just like I could be playing on a Telecaster right now and make it work. I'm not good enough to do that, but like somebody could. But yeah, so I had to play drums because there were only like two people in town or three people in town, depending. And if they were all busy, there you go.
Yeah. Okay. And you live in a very unique part of the universe, Los Angeles, where this scene, this, you know, early dance music scene is roaring and still roaring way past, you know, it might have been more of a fad in some parts of the country. When you started doing this, like, were you able to make a living out of the gate as a musician accompanying dances, or did you have a day job? You said you went to law school too at some point along the ride.
Yeah. So I managed to start our band in college. Like I jokingly say I have eight bands because I actually do have eight different like bands.
Of course you do.
But like our main band is called the Campus Five, which is a joke on Artie Shaw's Gramercy Five, because I was in college when I started it. And then I later have a big band, the Jonathan Stout Orchestra, and then I have several different variations and different sizes for different things. But those are sort of the two main ones. And I started it in college, and then I went to law school, and I was doing the band throughout law school. And then I graduated from law school, and I literally took the California bar exam. It's a you know, 3-day thing. I walk out of the Thursday, you know, last day of testing. I get in my car, I drive to the hotel where my singer's event Camp Hollywood is, and I get on stage and play with my big band like with no detour whatsoever. I think in honor of literally taking the bar exam, I didn't even change out of like shorts for the first set. I was like, screw it, man. I just did a thing, and I passed remarkably. And I ended up practicing law for, I mean, I still, you know, I was in court like 3 weeks ago. So I still practice law, but I was doing, it's funny, I wanted to be a prosecutor, too many episodes of Law and Order. And I volunteered in the DA's office, interned in the DA's office. And I just happened to graduate in 2008, big hiring crash, you know, and I get to the round where I meet the district attorney. Like, this is the thing where you're like, unless you say something really dumb, like you've already been hired, you just your chance to like, you know, fumble the ball at the 1 yard line. And at that point, they had changed, like all of the people they'd sent to him. They're like, oh no, actually, as it turns out, the 120 people I'm going to meet with, I'm actually only going to hire 40 because we can't afford. And so I was like totally in free fall. And I managed to like luck out getting this gig where I did traffic ticket defense. Which is great because you're not defending axe murderers, which is a lot easier to reconcile. But I would do like traffic tickets and minor, you know, traffic related misdemeanors. So I've done like defended like 20,000 some odd traffic tickets and, you know, thousands of misdemeanors, 300 DUIs, like all these kind of things. And I would just go into court and, you know, hang out with the cops or the prosecutors and just like work it out, you know, and that's 99% of like what happens is you're working it out. And, you know, the criminal justice system is a dark place and there's not good stuff happening and there's things that aren't right happening. And I definitely saw some of that stuff, but this gig doing traffic defense was amazing because I worked for this big, big firm that just did like 100 cases a day per attorney. It was bonkers. And you basically be like an installation in the court, like a public defender, except you're not public. but what's really good is like, if you just didn't schedule anything on a Friday, you could not come to work on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And especially at the beginning, like you could work it out with the court, like, hey, I've got all of these cases the rest of this week. Do you want to just do them all today? And they'd be like, oh yeah, we'll get them all done. And then we don't have to do them the next couple of days. And so like you could really flex your schedule. And right around then, or actually still when I was in law school, the idea of like a swing band that played specifically for dancers was still like an incredibly novel thing in like 2002. That was like a bonkers idea. And within like 2 years, we start flying out places to play, not because like I was the world's greatest guitar player, not because we were the world's greatest band, but because anybody who played this music better than we did sucked at playing for dancers. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Like if you're Yngwie Malmsteen, but you can't like, you know, play the thing they hired you to play, like, that's great. Like, thanks for the whole Toccata and Fugue thing, buddy. But like, we needed you to play this, and that's kind of not what it is. And the only other bands that were sort of trying to do that were more sort of traditional jazz bands, kind of Dixieland bands. Mm-hmm. And that was, so again, like more of that 1 in 3 music. It wasn't the thing like swing with a capital S. And so, and the other thing is when you're into a genre and people go, oh, you like that genre. And then they say the most obvious song in that genre. And you're like, well, yeah. You know, if you're like a thrash metal fan and people are like Enter Sandman, you're like, well, yeah, that's good. But like, you know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. Have you Battery or Damage Inc? Like that's the, or whatever. Yeah. And so people, any swing dancer knows what it's like. If you've been dancing long enough to like do like a gig for pay, you know what it's like to have some random regional big band. Like they hire you to play and dance one song, and then they start playing Sing Sing Sing, which is a relatively fast song. Dun, 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 dun. And then it goes into a drum solo that'll never end. And you're just hung out to dry of like, keep doing all of your biggest tricks over and over and over again. And you're like, no, I've got 3 minutes of material at best. It's like, all right, it's the seventh minute of, so we've all been tortured by things like Sing 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 and In the Mood. So like part of our thing was we're in the community. We know like what songs we're sick of, and we know what like the good deep cuts are. And just like a hip hop DJ digging the crates, like we would find good stuff. And so for many years, like the only extant recordings of some of our repertoire was like an original recording from the 30s or 40s and then our re-recording, because we were the only ones kind of featuring these songs. And this is, again, like sort of not quite at the streaming era, but people could download and, you know, you could get on Amazon, just buy CDs willy-nilly. But still, some of these songs were sort of deep cuts. So the fact that we could play for a dance crowd and then not bore them with material they're over, and then play good tempos and stuff meant, like I said, within 2 years, we were flying places. Within 3 years, we're like playing at Lincoln Center, does this big outdoor dance festival called Midsummer Night Swing. And within like 3 years of being a professional musician or playing at a professional level, I mean, obviously, like, you can argue about whether I was making my living from it, but playing with professionals, I'm like headlining a thing at Lincoln Center's summer festival with my big band, like, that was bonkers. But then again, like, nobody was doing that thing yet in that way. And it was, again, like, I didn't realize at the time that it was this entirely postmodern thing that had never before existed. I just thought, like, oh, everybody forgot how to play for dancers. And I was like, nope, this is a new thing. But eventually, like, I got out of school, got a job. And because this job was flexible and I could, like, schedule it, it was like, okay, yeah, so I'm going to fly out this day and I'll fly back. I'll fly out this day. So we would do these fly dates, you know, up to like toward like 2016, when we'd been in it like 15 years or so, like, it was like 2-3 a month sometimes. And internationally, like, we've played Korea like 3 times, and Budapest, London twice, Bordeaux, Heidelberg, like all these different places, Spain. Because this Lindy Hop thing isn't just like this American thing. Those people that post kind of Zoot Suit style revival, like, stayed with it. Like, it's all over the place. And you wouldn't believe, like, I don't know if it is currently, but like Seoul, South Korea, is like, they have like the most number of people currently dancing of anywhere on earth, like, doing swing dancing. And they're really good, which is insane. Just like the fact, like, some random country in the world, like, crushes it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this thing our people created. Awesome.
Incredible. Your band, I mean, you are like the greatest advocate, public speaker for this kind of music imaginable. Was your band, was the Campus Five, like, as kind of, you know, were they as into this music and playing the role of music historian as you were, or were you the one really going and chasing these old records and kind of indoctrinating them on, like, we got to learn this one?
Well, what I did was I picked people, and this is what I've always done. I picked people that already know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And because you can't, it's like playing a historical style of music. It's like trying to do a Christopher Guest movie that's historically accurate. Like, you're trying to improvise in the style of a thing that existed, and all the beats have to happen, but you're not actually quoting the dialogue verbatim.
Sure.
So, like, you have to pick people that already know what it sounds like. And, you know, I don't actually live in the 30s. I can't pretend like I have never heard any other kind of music, but that's kind of what I'm trying to do in one way, is like, keep those other influences so that I can kind of do it true to that era. And so I just picked people that already kind of played in the style, and their interests were definitely not the same as mine, because many of them also play other styles, but like, I could use them for my nefarious purpose of kind of perpetrating this 1930s swing dance music. But yeah, it's like you want somebody to have a British accent, like, you either have to find somebody who natively has one or can do a very good one.
Sure.
Because we're playing for a bunch of people that can hear you're like, oh no, that's Northern. No, the character's from Dover. You're doing it wrong. You know, those little ticks. And my main thing was like, I just don't want to be the band that sounds like the guy in Braveheart who's wearing a wristwatch. Cause like, once you see that, you can't unsee it. And so like, I'm just trying to sort of get those, like, you know, really transgressive anachronisms out of what we're doing. But like, each person has to kind of be themselves. So like, yeah, it was my goal to like recreate these things and carry these things on. But I just picked people, like my sax player for all these years. You know, his favorite things are Illinois Jacquette, the famous tenor player that played with Lionel Hampton, who played the famous solo on Flying Home. And then like Edgar Winter and Tower of Power.
Sure.
You know, like, he loves funk music, but it's just, I don't want the part of him that does funk music. I want the part of him that loves that old style tenor sax. And so he's able to do that. And then when he's on another gig, it's like, oh yeah, he brings out the flute to play whatever jazzy jazz. I'm like, just don't bring the flute to this gig.
Yeah. You mentioned a few guitarists, Alan Roos in particular, that I want to circle back upon, because I know you can go for a while on that. And I don't know that too many of our listeners to this podcast, as intelligent as you all are, will know exactly who Alan Roos is out of the gate. You're also holding this beautiful L5 that nobody can see. So we're going to talk about gear in a second. But before we get to that, there's something interesting here where, you know, your records, for the most part, and you have a whole bunch of them with the Campus 5, and they're great, but they reflect your role in serving the dancer, which means that, as you said, like, there's not a lot of, the guitar playing is spectacular, but it's not up front and with a bunch of flashy solos. You're serving your audience. And it's sort of easy to understand how you could go jump from playing the L5 to getting behind the drum kit, because it's all about the rhythm. It's all about serving the audience. Can you talk a little bit about that and your role as a guitarist there? Because it's a little different than what most people think of as a jazz guitarist.
Yeah. I mean, you're not just it's not like round robin. Paul F. Tompkins, the comedian, has this great joke about how jazz is this joke perpetrated by the smart people on you, the dumb people, in his character, like persona as being, oh, I'm the smartest person. You're all dumb. And I'll give you this advice for free. And he does this bit about how it's like, it's not the music where the best person gets a solo. No, it's the person where everybody gets a solo, even the bass player. And it's like, you know, you fall down some stairs and you wake up and you're in a jazz club. We've all had that nightmare. Anyway, like, but in this style, like, you're not doing round robin where everybody gets a whole solo and there's, you know, or maybe multiple choruses of a solo. There are these like arrangements, and they're concise. And it's, you know, originally part of it was because you're on a 3.5 minute record. And so maybe live, they would have played it a little bit longer, but like, you know, you get your 16 bars, your 8 bars, you know, cause they got to fit everybody in. I mean, a lot of times the guitarist didn't get a solo because acoustic guitar trying to cut through a big band is like well nigh impossible. Like, it really would require some kind of amplification or like moving the guitar really close to the microphone for that part of the song. But so, yeah, in that capacity as dance band, like, yeah, I did like a kind of Django style version of Dark Eyes where I get to take a big guitar solo. But it's like, OK, well, that's one song. And then the next two songs, like, I'm not going to take a solo. I'll take like a solo over just a bridge here. I do a lot of Charlie Christian tunes. And so, yeah, I get my one chorus of solo there. But it's not like the world's greatest showcase of the history of jazz guitar playing, but it is kind of accurate to the lack of being featured. But I've been struggling lately because with doing things like Instagram, I've got a lot of attention of people that have never heard some of the things like Alan Roos, and they're really interested in hearing more of that and hearing me do it, but I'm not really giving them a product. So I'm actually going to be doing like a quartet CD where it really features that sort of prominently. And, you know, actually, like our last Campus 5 gig, I actually decided, you know what, I'm going to write a tune where like I play the melody in this chord style, and then I'll take a solo too, just so I have like a feature for that. Because a lot of times somebody like Alan Roos wouldn't even necessarily get a solo. He might get like a little 4-bar interlude or set up a key change. And those are little kind of concerted bits, but it's not the same thing as like doing, you know, chord melody stunt guitar. So, but yeah, no, I haven't done that. I'm looking forward to sort of branching out a little bit of that, but it's definitely not the kind of thing where I can do that at a dance club and it goes over as well. But I'm hoping that maybe like if I get hired to do a dance weekend somewhere, maybe I can hit the jazz club in town on a Thursday night and do like a you know, quartet. And then the next night I go do the dance band and kind of serve both of those audiences.
Yeah. You're like the next in the very long lineage of LA session guitarists who then have to go once, so, you know, on the weekend and go show off what they can actually do. Cause it's all kind of, you know, hidden otherwise. Alan Roos, you keep talking about, we're going to get to that in 30 seconds. Before that, though, maybe this is a dumb question. I don't know the answer to this. Was Django playing for dancers?
I mean, everyone was playing for dancers. I mean, that's the thing I think people don't realize is like everyone was playing at these social events for people to meet and congregate and often dance. And the thing, though, is dancers is something different then than it is now, mm-hmm. because even at a place like the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem, the birthplace of Lindy Hop, the main swing dance, it wasn't like 500 people that were all trained, excellent Lindy Hoppers that could social dance intelligently. It was normal people on dates, mm-hmm. trying to make a match, you know what I mean? And then sure. 20 jitterbugs in the corner waiting for the fast song to come in to show off. But like even at the Savoy, they're doing waltzes, foxtrots, rumbas, different things mixed in. And so like the dance audience back then was a lot of normal people on dates that didn't necessarily like Lindy Hop in a particularly good way. And now the only people that I'm playing for, maybe they're not all like top flight competitive swing dancers. They're all like pretty good Lindy Hoppers. So they want a different thing. But everybody was playing for dancers, but somebody like Django probably wouldn't have been playing as often in a big ballroom. He would have been playing in a club because nobody could hear the guitar in a giant ballroom without some kind of additional amplification. And that's, sure. that's why you have big bands to fill these spaces in pre-amplified times or kind of right around the cusp of the beginning of amplification.
Got it. Thank you. That makes perfect sense. Alan Roos. Let's hear about Alan Roos. Who, give me the spiel. Give me the 101 on who he was, why he is important to you. When we were talking 2 weeks ago, you talked a lot about him. I want to hear everything.
So yeah, he's this incredibly forgotten figure. I mean, like, I think I looked up his Google image results once and I'm like the fifth thing. I'm like, why am I the fifth thing? Like, that's
you personally are the fifth thing. OK,
like that doesn't make sense. Like, I'm the only person talking about him enough that my search results come up. But no, Alan Roos was a student of the great George Van Epps. And in 1934, Van Epps was playing guitar in the Goodman Band, the Benny Goodman Band, before they became famous. And the story goes basically that they were playing in New York and they were playing on this radio show and it was being broadcast in prime time on the East Coast. But because of the time zones, it was basically be playing at like, you know, 11 o'clock or midnight on the West Coast. And basically the kids would stay up late and listen to this hot swing music. But like a lot of the people in the middle of the country weren't really interested in it as much. And so they were playing this kind of new hot swing music and George Van Epps was in the band and he got a gig with Ray Noble and he left the band and he said, oh, here, I've got the perfect guy for you, Benny. Here's the student that's been taking lessons with me. And it was this guy, Alan Roos. He was driving a milk truck and he joins the band. Gene Krupa is in the band at that point. And then that band is the band that goes cross country, has this terrible time where they're trying to play this hot swing music and then none of the people are interested in it. And it isn't until they get to California and have a show in Oakland and then this very famous show at the Palomar Ballroom here in LA where they actually finally play for the new kids that really want this new music. And that's sort of the birth of the swing era, according to most historians, even though obviously like black bands had been playing swing music for a year or two.
But there's like one concert. It's like the riot at Stravinsky's Rite of Spring where everybody's like, this is the watershed moment.
Yeah, it's the Beatles on Ed Sullivan of the swing era. And basically like that's the thing that kicks it off in the public white consciousness. And Alan Roos is in the band. And as this band really coalesces from this kind of proto swing starting to swing into like the sui generis of swing, like the swing with a capital S swing, he's the guy in the band. And he basically creates the style of rhythm guitar based on what Van Epps had taught him, based on people with like in Chick Webb's band, like John Trueheart was doing. And somebody like Eddie Lang would like kind of throw in little interjections and arpeggiations instead of just playing chunk, 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 chunk. Mm-hmm. And what I think Alan Roos really coalesces around is like, nope, just chunk, 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 just that four to the bar, what most people consider quote unquote Freddie Green rhythm is really something that Alan Roos, I think, innovates. And not to say that other people weren't doing it, but like the way that he did it becomes sort of the dominant definitive way. And so he's with Benny through the height of his first burst of fame, through the 35, 36, 37, 38 is the Carnegie Hall concert. That's a big deal. And then soon after leaves the band. But George Van Epps was also this amazing chord soloist. But when Roos would do it, because he was in this really just slamming hot swing band, that was really the bleeding edge of like hot swing music, he played more swinging. And there's a couple important stories about Roos and his rhythm guitar I want to mention is, I've talked to Al Green, Freddie Green's son, a little bit on Facebook, and I know that it's not in the biography that he wrote of his dad, and it's not a thing that he thinks happened. But I've seen it from a couple different sources that basically when Freddie Green came to New York and needed to get his rhythm guitar together, he went to go take lessons with George Van Epps, and Van Epps said, no, go take lessons from Alan Roos. And so he was taking lessons with Alan Roos. And so like the thing that we think of as Freddie Green rhythm guitar, like I said, is really Alan Roos style. And the story goes that basically like when Basie really kind of like clicks and Freddie Green joins Basie's band, and then it really starts to click, Benny immediately is like, oh no, that's the new thing. And there's sort of like slightly more relaxedness to the Kansas City Count Basie vibe, as opposed to Benny's like really super aggressive style. So he wants to like, okay, now let's do that. And he says to Alan Roos, he goes, hey, if you're this new guy, Freddie Green, you should go take some lessons with him. He's like, Benny, that guy's been coming over to my house to take lessons with me for 6 months. And, you know, I've seen that quoted in a couple places, Steve Jordan's biography. And then, but the other thing is I found this interview of Freddie Green in the 70s, and the interviewer just says, what were your influences in playing rhythm guitar? John Trueheart from Chick Webb's band and Alan Roos from Benny Goodman's band. I'm like, all right. So if he's going to name drop two people, seems pretty good. But that style of kind of four to the bar, what we think of as Freddie Green rhythm guitar, Alan's really the cat, and he's on, goes through many different big bands, ends up in the studios alongside people like Barney Kessel and Tommy Tedesco and, you know, all of those greats. So he's on a million records, Sinatra records in the 50s and stuff. He's on the background of the Haunted Mansion ride at Disneyland, soundtracks, all sorts of stuff. But besides just being like kind of a really great rhythm guitar player and on many great records, he develops this chord melody solo style that is really like light years ahead of like all of the contemporaries, because he really makes it swing the way like a single string player does. And because of that old website, classicjazzguitar.com, that no longer exists, I found all of these little samples of those, just like excerpts where I heard these solos. And I spent 20 years marveling at them and trying to assemble a way of doing it, but I could never transcribe. And then sort of during the pandemic, it really, really came together, because the transcriptions that are out there, they're just not quite right. And I was extrapolating and then getting things wrong, because I was extrapolating for something that wasn't quite right. But I found SoundSlice, this great website, which is a great learning tool if you just buy somebody's transcription of something or get a free transcription. But the editor in SoundSlice to make the music is actually a really profound tool to transcribe yourself. And I basically I cracked it. I figured out how to do it finally. And I started with a Van Epps solo. And then once I got that, I started moving on to Roos. And after I did about five or six, I started realizing, oh, okay, no, I thought he was doing this, but he's actually doing this. And like something like this, I call it the honeysuckle rose lick. I was like, oh, okay, that's how I would normally finger that. But he's actually doing, sorry, that's a different key, but I'm just fingering it in a different place. And then I realized, oh, there's this whole system of sliding positions around. And it's actually like way easier than what I'd been doing. And I spent like a lot of the 5 years before that learning a lot of solo chord melody guitar. And that's a lot harder, because if you're just playing by yourself, if a chord goes from like the 2 to the 5, you have to change that one note. Otherwise, no one's going to hear it. And Alan Roos is playing with a band, and he's just sort of floating above it and going, jumping back and forth between those two willy-nilly and doesn't care because the bass player's got it. But yeah, so Alan Roos was just this really profound chord melody soloist, and he's really almost practically forgotten because Charlie Christian comes along, my other hero, my son's namesake, and this electric guitar thing. It's like, who wants to do these cool chord melody solos when you can play like a big fat tenor sax style solo on this new electric guitar? But Alan Roos just had this way. I'll just sort of like, you know, do a little bit of it, but like, like that kind of sliding swash, I call it swashbuckling, where he's just like, and that's all chords. And you're like, oh, well, that's, you know, like it sounds like single notes, but there's all these chords underneath. So he's got this crazy style. But it's really hard to feature because he was doing it mostly on acoustic guitar. And so you can only really do that in the studio if you move the guitar player real close or, you know, he moves close to the microphone. So it just fell out of fashion. And he was like winning polls in like even as late as 1944. But like after that, it's just he's almost like erased from history, like Marty McFly disappearing from a photo in 1985. But it's this just amazing, cool thing. So I really love publicizing it. And one thing on the acoustic tip, just because this is one of my things, I owe having a career to the fact that any of the great people that came before me, most of them who are still doing it, somebody like Howard Alden, doesn't play acoustic guitar on gigs. He shows up with a Benedetto and that's just what he does. And he was a great student of George Van Epps later in Van Epps's life. So he went seven string and never went back. And, you know, but like the fact that I really force myself to play both acoustic and electric guitar separately on the same gig, there it's a different timbre, it's a different thing. And I really found that later I found this picture of Alan Roos in the 40s playing with Harry James, and he's got his blonde L5 that was his main guitar since 1938. But then next to him, there's what I'm pretty sure is a ES-300 with the kind of Stratocaster style bridge pickup. And that if he had to take a solo live, like he would stop playing acoustic rhythm, put it down, pick up the other guitar. And I found the same thing with a picture of Barney Kessel and Artie Shaw's band in 1945, where sure, he was excited about the electric guitar, but he wasn't going to play rhythm on an electric guitar because the timbre is just not right. And the time feel is just totally wrong when sort of the artificial sustain of tube amp compression kind of makes the notes ring too long. It doesn't work. So I really like loved playing the rhythm, the acoustics and the electric separately. But even Alan Roos, like on Air Checks, even before Charlie Christian kind of makes his great public debut in 1939, he's probably playing an ES-150 with Jack Teagarden's band to take a solo live. But then in the studio, most of it was still acoustic because they wanted his rhythm playing. And if they were going to give him a solo, you know, they didn't want to compromise the rhythm playing.
Incredible. Thank you. Thank you for telling me. there are a couple of Alan Roos tracks on your Pick It and Play It CD, which features your guitar playing really nicely. Do you have more ambitious plans to share more of what you've learned or record a record, or is it too early to say?
Well, what's funny is he put out like a guitar folio of these like solo guitar pieces in 1938. And you always wonder like if those are ghostwritten, but like part of what I was doing before I actually really learned his solos was sort of extrapolating from his solo guitar compositions, but they're a little bit different and they're like composed pieces. But I was happy to feature them. There's like, I think six more pieces in the book. But it's funny, like, you know, some people they say are visual learners, auditory. Me looking at a piece of sheet music, even though I can read it, is like, you know, impossible to like really get it. Like I almost have to put it in MIDI and then have it play back at me to hear it. But I'm not sure when I'll get around to doing the rest of those pieces, but I definitely know I want to do, cause that Pick It and Play It CD is literally solo guitar.
Yeah.
And when you're just by yourself, that means you can't stop. You literally can't stop. Otherwise the music stops. And there's all these tricks you have to do to extend. And even somebody like Alan Roos, when he's chord soloing over a band, there's all these things you do where you're like, all right, I got four bars of one chord. How the hell am I going to like string together four bars of ideas? Because if I just play like D7 at the 10th fret and go, okay, well, after a couple bars, you're like, okay, what now? And so he would have all these tricks like kind of sliding, holding one finger barring and then keeping the top note the same as he moved it down, just to kind of like extend the time horizon on all of those chords. But I know I've got all these transcriptions that I did in SoundSlice, and it's like my most cherished work product. And the other thing is my charts for the band are like, I wouldn't give those to anybody for any reason, because then you could just do the thing that I do and like, you know, take my charts. Not that you can't copy them off the record that we've done, but you have to do that. Like I did that with all of these old records that I was sort of copying. Sure. And then because of listening to those old charts, I learned how to do it. And then at a certain point, the futility of merely recreating old arrangements off records kind of dawned on me when we went to Bordeaux. And I had transcribed this really deep cut song called Black Market Stuff. And then that was the title track of that band's album. And I was like, oh, I thought I was so cool for finding this deep cut. And then like, oh no, that's their title track. Oh, maybe we need to do our own thing. So we started writing original tunes and doing original arrangements of old tunes, just because it's like, well, at a certain point, if you can get the milk from somebody else, like, I better make some strawberry milk or something just so I have something worthwhile. But as far as like a CD and the kind of the Alan Roos stuff, I'm excited to sort of teach more with that stuff and use those as examples. At some point, I'm sure I'll just start like putting up on SoundSlice for sale or whatever. But I want to do like a quartet CD where I can really feature that style of guitar playing kind of the way that he was featured on some of the recordings. But yeah, it's wild stuff, and it is real hard to transcribe at first, but then once you get it, you're like, oh, okay, he's doing one of those again.
And just to be clear, to save a dozen or so people from doing a Google search right now, the stuff you've been doing on SoundSlice is not available. It's not public facing. This is just on your private machine.
Yeah, yeah. And I do have some stuff on SoundSlice that I have made public. Like there's a John Trueheart chord ballad example. There's an Irving Ashby solo, which is really cool. Like a Charlie Christian thing, a couple of bits of my playing. And then I did a course for the DC Music School that Dennis Chang does. He's often in the jazz manouche world, but he's also done these courses via SoundSlice. You have to go to his website, dc-music.com, but SoundSlice is the architecture for it.
Yeah.
But he had Pat Martino do it. He had Angelo DeBar, all these famous jazz manouche players, but also some more modern ones. Jocelyn Gould did one. And basically the thing is, it's not lessons necessarily, but it's here, I'm going to have this famous jazz person blow over changes and I'm going to transcribe it meticulously. And there you go. Now you don't have to like actually transcribe it. It's there for you, but you got to do it.
Sure.
And then there'll be some talking, but it's a really cool thing. And I'm excited to like explore doing private lessons with it, using the examples I played as sort of the teaching examples.
Sure.
You know?
Now you did just teach at Matt Munisteri's Red Hot Strings Workshop here in Washington State. What was actually the class called, or what did you teach?
I did a rhythm guitar class and I did a chord melody class. And okay. I've struggled for years with trying to teach people the chord melody thing, because I'm thinking of it in a certain advanced way of thinking about these shapes, and it's just all become second nature. But it was a real breakthrough this year, because I got like a class of 20 people of varying ability levels all sort of playing chord melody stuff, and it was amazing. And being asked to teach at that camp was like such an honor. Matt's one of those players that I just go like, oh man, that's the real thing. He's like the, you know, just amazing. And so when he asked me to do it, I was like, me? Okay. But yeah, it was really cool. We got like 20 campers, and it was really about breaking it down. Like, okay, you got a chord. All right. So put three fingers down on a chord, like a C, like the C on the top four strings of a guitar, like, you know, at the 10th and 8th frets, like 10, 9, 8, 8. Now, like, like just use your pinky and hit all of the white notes of the piano, a C scale that you can hit easily. Okay, and then you can also get the E here, so try sliding into those. And then like, okay, class, make moise and screw around with that for, for, you know, a minute and a half. And they were all doing it. And then it's like, okay, well, let's play exactly like you. And then the next chord's D7. So you get a D7 where it's like 10, 11, 10, 10. It's like, okay, what are the right notes you can reach? And like having mess around with that and going, oh, anytime there's two frets apart, you can always play the chromatic in between. So, and when you do that, you can always slide the chord up and get some cool contrary motion. Then they're all doing that for like a minute and okay, the next chord. And they were all actually doing it. And it was really cool. That camp, by the way, just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about, no one can see this, of course, but the L5 that you're holding, and there's a couple cool guitars in the background that I want to hear about.
Yeah. The funniest joke is when people are like, you're L5. And I was like, which one? Huh? Which is the most ridiculous thing. And I'm making fun of myself when I say that. But no, you know, I was really lucky that I got a certain point with working a day job and having a wife that's a working professional and a solid union job, that, you know, we got a little bit of money at a certain point and I could start looking at vintage guitars that I thought would be unattainable. And I picked up a 1937 ES-150 that I just got a screaming deal on. And that sort of set me on the path. And it was funny because I didn't become a better player by having it, but people took me more seriously all of a sudden.
Sure, sure.
And it's sort of funny, but it kind of opened the door to that. And then having the guitar sound exactly like it's supposed to sound without me having to do anything really made it easier to do the thing. And we kind of had this moment where like I was going to have the most disposable income I was ever going to have because we're going to have kids and then forget that after that point. And I bought a couple of guitars sort of like looking for the guitar because this is my one shot. And then Norm's Rare Guitars bought this whole collection. They bought like $2 million worth of guitars. And I fell in love with this one particular small body L5 because that's what I thought would be the thing, like one of these 16-inch L5s from the late 20s or early 30s. And like what Matt plays basically. And I go and I fall in love with number 90303, killer guitar, great guitar. And I go back three different times. I bring the guitars that I had bought in the meantime to test it out and compare. And as I'm like on there the third time with the authorization from the wife to buy it, I realized there's a pile of cases that I didn't realize we hadn't gone through. And it's five more small body L5s. You're like, man, it hasn't been since the 30s that all of these kind of guitars would be together. And I found this one, which is 88784. And I was like, oh, this one's way better. And it's like Matt's, where it's got the non-kerfed bracing. So it's solid braces. So it's built like a dot neck, even though it's got a block neck on it. And it's one of those transitional ones. But this is sort of my desert island guitar. And it's just, it's rich. It's got a nice bottom end. It's sparkly. It's lovely. It's easy. It's relatively easy to play most of the time. And I can put a DeArmond like guitar mic or FHC on it and kind of do acoustic and electric at the same time. But I was struggling because I would be playing in my dance band, you know, what I do. And it just didn't kind of punch to the back of the room. And I was visiting, we were playing in Denver and I stopped by Old Town Pick and Parlor and my buddy Kit, who owns the shop, we always kind of have a guitar hang when I'm in town. And I know he's helped part of that whole Rocky Mountain Guitar, Archtop Guitar Festival they're doing, which I would kill to fly myself to at some point. But he had this big body, late 40s L5 that just like was carried across the room. And I was like, oh, that's the thing I actually need in a dance band. That's what Gibson evolved the L5 into to do that job. So after kind of like months and months of cyberstalking this one guitar at Eric Schoenberg's shop, and by the way, the podcast that you did with him was just fascinating. And I loved every bit of that and hearing that guy talk. But he had this blonde 1939 L5. And I went into his shop and it was like, okay, this is cool. But I was having a hard time going, is this good? I'm a kid. When I started playing guitar, I didn't put it on the bridge pickup for like 2 or 3 years. Because I was like, why would anybody want that bright kind of sound? And you're like, oh, when you play with other people, you actually, then the bass player's got the low end.
Sure.
You know, like the idea of playing like a Telecaster to an AC30 for me was like, why would you want an ice pick? But of course, like, oh, that's a sound. And when you add it in the context of this other thing, it fits into a mix. So Eric did the coolest thing ever. He's like, well, do you want to just take it for a couple of days and see?
It's a classic drug dealer move.
First taste is free. Exactly. And so I had basically like conceived a way to like get a gig in San Francisco so I could go visit the guitar. My good friend, Nick Rossi, a great LA or Bay Area, swing guitar player up there. He, drove me around and we visited a couple different spots and then ended up at Eric's. And Eric said, we'll just take the gig with you. So I'd take the guitar with you. So I got to play it on a gig the next night. And the AB test was like, oh, this is the thing. So that's sort of my main acoustic guitar nowadays for live. Because it punches through. It's got this very pronounced mid-range honk that cuts through a mix. It's got a real nice upper range peak that helps the brilliance cut through. But, you know, like when I listen to it by itself, sometimes it feels a little honky, a little kind of shrill, but then it's like in a mix, it's like, oh man, that's the way. And by the way, the way that I deal with this whole like amplification thing is I've never heard of like a bridge transducer that really makes an arch top sound like an arch top, but I've heard like contact transducers and they just kind of make them sound like a piezoelectric flat top to me. And some people have better luck. I just never was one of those people. And I figured out that a lot of the cats in the Django world will use like a lavalier mic kind of clipped on, and that was a way to go. So I started doing that and I realized, well, that's cool, but now you don't have a volume knob to roll down. And I realized, oh, if I get a mute pedal, I can turn it off when I put the guitar down, so it's not like feeding back into the monitors or whatever. And so I ended up going from an Audio Technica to this DPA 4099 that a lot of the Django cats use. And it's life changing because I can get archtop acoustic guitar like at stage volume levels as long as I like have the monitor pointed at me from the side, because then it's at a 90 degree angle, the mic. It's amazing. But so basically my ES-150 is my main electric. I play that when I can into a 1939 EH-185, which is sort of like the Charlie Christian amp that the chassis lifts out of. So it looks like the first stack almost. And then I'll either, because that's a really heavy and a little fragile, there's a company out of San Pedro here in Southern California, Vintage 47, that makes sort of a semi-replica. And then the other thing I do is I had them make me just a cab, and then I have a quilter head. And there's a great guitar builder out of Tulsa, or Norman, actually, Oklahoma, Jason Combs, who I just met at Matt's guitar camp because he was one of the campers and great player, great builder. But he built a pedal that's basically an EH-150 in a box. And so I go with that into a quilter, or if I'm flying out, I'll just go into the, you know, the Fender Hot Rod deluxe backline amp du jour. I'll go straight into the effects return and bypass the front end of the amp and just use it as a power amp. So I basically got an EH-185 or 150 in a box. And so that's what I use, either the real thing or one of those two replicas. And then I've got these two L5s, and sometimes I'll do the DeArmond on this 32 L5, and I have an AER, a little acoustic amp for like, you know, regular gigs where I don't have front of house, because, you know, we don't always have front of house engineers and a PA system. Sometimes it's just a bar gig, but I have an AER and it's got two channels. So sometimes I'll do the mic into one channel, and then I'll have the DeArmond into that JJ-150 pedal that Jason makes. And I'll basically have a tuner pedal so I can mute one or mute the other. And I'll basically be playing acoustic rhythm or acoustic chord solos, hit two pedals, and then I'm take a Charlie Christian style solo. And then just for fun, because I love them. I also have like a modern National Tricone, because I love the sound of Nationals. That guy, John Reynolds, kind of famously plays both a tricone and a single cone. And those new Nationals that they've been making in San Luis Obispo for the last like 30 years almost now, they're so amazing. They're so good. I've never played a vintage one that made me think, oh, I'd rather have this than one of these modern ones. It plays amazing. So one of the tracks, no, never mind. I didn't do a track on my album with that, but I love this Tricone. It's the best, one of the best solo guitars, because it's got all this kind of natural reverb. And then just to round things out, I picked up a Waterloo, one of those Collings kind of versions of a Kalamazoo, It's the WL14 with the ladder bracing. Man, that's a monster guitar. And the one track on my album, Itching Fingers, is with that. And that's off Pick It and Play It. I love that guitar. That's super fun. But that's my only flat top. So that's the guitarology.
I love it. I love it. And are you still getting people out of traffic tickets?
Yeah, occasionally. I have a couple things on the docket. At this point, what I mostly do is, like, you know, if you're a musician and you can't make a gig, you can send, you know, depending on what the gig is, like, you could send, if you're in a big band and you're a sax player and something happens, you can send another sax player, theoretically, if they're a good professional musician. So what I do is, like, other attorneys that have more than one court appearance at a day, they'll call me to substitute for them. And because I can actually do the thing, like, I can also, like, kind of dig in and do the work when I'm there and not just sort of, like, kick the can down the road for them. So that's what I mostly do court wise. Why have you got a traffic ticket?
No, I don't, but I love that you used a music analogy. I was like, where's he going with this? If you're a sax player, but of course you're the legal equivalent of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you can send us, that's the thing. Like, you can send a sub if the person knows what they're doing, and depending on what it is, like, you know, a lot of times in a lot of these cases, you're just meeting to talk with somebody, ask for more information, and then come back another day after you've done some more research or whatever. And it's like, yeah, you don't really necessarily need the attorney of record to show up. You could have somebody do it, or, you know, but, like, I'm somebody that can get in there and negotiate and actually kind of get some stuff done if they want. But I'm also a little more expensive because I'm like, if you're going to make me do work, like, you know, this isn't just like, you know, here's $50. Can you just show up for me? No, it's like, come on. Yeah.
I think you're the only lawyer I've met who's kept that fact on the down low of, like, yeah. And then once in a while I sub in, like, it's usually more of a defining thing as a career for most people, but I love that you have all this other stuff
going on. I had this moment though, because when I didn't get that job in the DA's office, that was, like, major trauma for me. And it was like a real bummer, you know, like, not everybody's life works out the way they think it's going to. And that was my dream. And I thought, like, oh, I'm going to do that thing. And then for fun, I'll play music. And I didn't get that gig. And then I was working on the opposite side, so to speak, for many years. And that was kind of hard in a lot of ways, because I'm like, well, no, but I wanted to do that thing. And then I'm having to argue with them. And, like, you're my dream. You're doing my dream wrong. Like, this is hard. But we do this event in Asheville, North Carolina. And we did it for about 6 years before the pandemic, and then a little bit of a hiatus, and we're sort of just getting back to it, where this year is really going to be kind of a return to form for it. But the guy that runs it, a good friend of mine, Michael Gamble, who's a great bass player and band leader, I play in his band often as well, even though he's out of Asheville. But he wanted to do, like, really double down. It's the 5 nights leading up to New Year's, and it's the same audience the whole time. So it's like one of these convention type things. And he wanted to do a full big band every night. And you're like, wait a second. You want to do 5 different shows for the same, because you can't do the same show. You can't play the same tunes. And he came up with the idea of, like, sort of, you know, in a rock parlance, kind of tribute nights, where we would do, like, a whole night of Benny Goodman with my big band, a whole night of Artie Shaw. And it's my big band because I get to lead it. But he started being like, oh, well, we can hire anybody from around the country that are the best people. So we were getting, you know, some of the very best people that are experts in this stuff. And then that sort of became what my orchestra is, really, is a lot of these, like, all-star people from around the country. And then our core of LA people in that. But because he was doing these tribute nights, we would have to, like, play 30 new songs. And I'd just gotten the charts, and I would have to talk a little bit in between them to, like, kind of give the musicians time to, like, look down at their chart and be like, do I need my clarinet for this song? Is there a mute that I need to have within reaching distance? You know, just to, like, because they were sight reading some of these. And I started talking and just storytelling a little bit about the context, just extemporaneously. And that became sort of one of the defining things of the event, is that it wasn't just about playing a night of Benny Goodman or Count Basie. It was, tell me about Count Basie. Let's learn about Count Basie. Let's learn about their famous all-star musicians in the band. Let's learn about, like, where these songs come from. And then, you know, in even before sort of the pandemic kind of reawakening of things, you know, talking about like the racial implications, a lot of this stuff, and the fact that, like, yeah, on the one hand, it's great that Benny Goodman was bringing people like Charlie Christian, Lionel Hampton, and Teddy Wilson, who were Black musicians, and bringing them into the, into his all white band, and kind of like standing up for that and featuring them. But he also couldn't have them in the band. They would have to do like a little sextet number or something, or a trio number, to feature them, because they couldn't be quote unquote in the band. And he's, so it's like, yeah, he's doing a good thing, but then it's also still kind of not enough. And then, you know, well, on the one hand, let's not hero worship him for doing the right thing. Like, you know, all of those dynamics. And after about 4 years of that, it really kind of coalesced into something. And like, we were doing the music of Chick Webb, and Michael had this great idea to crowdfund these transcriptions, because these charts don't exist. They're not out there. And we crowdfunded them, and then he made them available for sale, which is amazing. We crowdfunded them, and we did a night of the music of Chick Webb and Ella Fitzgerald that like probably hadn't been heard in 80 years played by live musicians. And like one of the songs, like, is the song that when we brought my son home from the hospital when he was born, like we listened to that song. It's called Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie. And like, so not just the context of these artists, but like our scenes. I tell the story about that. That becomes the defining thing of that event, you know, is the music, but also these stories and this education of it. And I realized like, oh, I'm better at this than anyone I know, because no one's doing this. And I'm not the best attorney I know. And I'd rather be the thing that I'm special at more than a thing I'm okay, I'm pretty good at, you know? So that really had this moment of like, no, I think this is the thing I'm on this earth to do, is highlight people like Alan Roos, tell the story of somebody like Charlie Christian, tell the story of all these great artists that I love, and the dancers too, like all of these great dancers that inspired me, and kind of keep their legacies going. You know, there's a lot of people that can be a good attorney, but you know, they can't play an Alan Roos style solo.
Wow. Great way to end it, Jonathan. Thank you. If open invite, come to the Fretboard Summit. If not this year, next year, teach us some of this stuff, because you're a fountain of knowledge, and I know a bunch of people are going to want to hear more.
Oh, I literally have the Fretboard Summit on my calendar, just going like, maybe if I'm not, if as long as I don't get a gig that weekend, or maybe I got some frequent flyer miles. So I would love to take you up on that at some point.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan.
Oh, thank you, man. What a pleasure.
All right. That was my conversation with Jonathan Stout, one of the great Fretboard Journal podcast guests, I think. I think you will agree, right? Share this episode with your friends. Thanks to all of our sponsors, and thanks to you all for checking out our quirky little show. Can't thank you enough.